Welcome to the Brown Riot podcast. Hey! This podcast is all about what it takes to be successful in advertising when you're from a different ethnic, cultural, or socio-economic background to the majority. Okay, our guest today is amazing. So I've been looking forward to this one for ages. She has an Indian background and she's from the UK. She got a scholarship to a posh girls' school in Cambridge and then went on to Oxford University. At DDB London, she worked on one of my favourite ever campaigns, Harvey Nichols' Calendars, before going on to various leadership positions including MD at Y&R London, where she was responsible for iconic campaigns for Virgin Media, the BBC and Marks & Spencer's, among others. She's a self-confessed lover of good books, fancy restaurants and cheesy R&B music. She's the MD of DDB Sydney, Priya Patel. Welcome, Priya.
Hello. What an intro.
Hello. Did you enjoy that?
It's like all my sins all on the first page.
Was
like,
it good or was it embarrassing?
The restaurants, the R&B. It's all very accurate. I'll take it. Thank
good,
you. It's
good,
very
good,
complimentary
good, good.
And lovely.
Okay, so can we sort of hone in on some of that intro then? So I mentioned the posh girls' school in Cambridge, I mentioned Oxford University. Having said that, your background actually sounds like it was pretty modest. You got a scholarship and I think you were the only brown person in your year at school. So I wanted to start by saying, you know, did you feel like an outsider at all? And maybe doubly so because of your ethnic background and your socioeconomic background.
Yeah. Well, it's a really interesting question, actually. I read your piece about why you started this podcast and why you started Brown Riot and your provocation around whether there was only enough room for one brown ECD, you know, in any space. And it actually got me remembering there was another Indian girl in my year and her name was actually Rhea Patel.
Wow.
So it was really similar. And actually thinking about it, I actually went out of my way not to be her friend. So like, I mean, so much so I've erased her from my memory and I think I'm the only brown person at school. And when I think about it, I think it's because I actually needed to make sure that I differentiated myself and that people didn't think we were the same person. There was this absolute paranoia from the very outset that everyone would just think we were the same because there wasn't enough sort of collective room for two Indian people potentially. So it's quite weird. And I think she was almost the opposite to me. She was very gentle and very quiet and quite elegant and I'm quite loud and brash. And I now sort of reflect whether I almost became who I am in opposition to who she was. And then I think conversely, you're surrounded by white friends and trying not to differentiate from them. So you're trying to push apart from the other brown person and you're trying to be more like the other white people. So try and speak the same, try and act the same, you know, try and have the same experiences. But, you know, the truth is we didn't. You know, they had these beautiful houses. Like it was ridiculous. Windmills, swimming pools. Like, honestly, one of my friends lived in a windmill.
Well.
They had swimming pools, tennis courts, you know, and we lived in quite a modest townhouse. My parents had started it as a flat and then
Where was this in
Cambridge?
Cambridge.
Yeah, so we were really central. Everyone else had these beautiful farms and these kind of, you know, acreages. But I suppose, and I remember I was paranoid about the difference. I was like paranoid that, you know, that my clothes would smell of curry or that when people came around my house, they'd be like, oh, it really smells and it's really small. But it was really weird. Over the years, and especially as I got older, I think the other was something that my friends really loved. So it was so different at our house. So my mum would come and pick us up from a nightclub at 2 a.m. No one else's mum would do that. But she's an Indian mum. You don't just let your kid go out until 2 a.m. You go and pick them up from the club. Or, you know, my dad would make a chicken curry on a Saturday night, every Saturday night. My friends would come around and they'd just nail it. They loved it, you know. And so, oddly, their love of my otherness, I think, gave me quite a lot of confidence. I was kind of like, actually, maybe it isn't that bad. Maybe it's actually something to be quite proud of. And yeah, so I think it's always that sort of juggling act of kind of trying to fit in and recognizing what's different about yourself, but seeing it kind of in a positive light rather than in a negative one.
So much of that, I relate to so much of that, not all of it, but so much of that is that you just said, because I went to an all boys Catholic school and there was one other brown kid, like an Indian kid in my year. And I subconsciously sort of wanted to set myself apart from him, but he was just so different from me. And I think maybe I did subconsciously think, I don't want to be lumped in with that guy. I think he was Joseph Patel. He was Joseph something. I can't remember his name. But what I definitely thought was that school and that experience just instilled in me a pathological need to fit in. I just did everything. You kind of touched on it, but I did everything I could to fit in. And that, I think that just made me like that to this day. I feel like I'm still fighting that need to fit in. And you talked about how when your friends sort of dug your otherness and got into the curry, the whatever, they're getting picked up, that made you celebrate the difference. I didn't really ever get to that stage until like many years later. I remember I sat down with one of my mentors, is Dave Trott, a guy called Dave Trott from London. And it was really only Dave Trott that really got me to flip that thinking on its head and see a difference as a benefit rather than something to be sort of afraid of or ashamed of. And so I was 10, 15 years behind you in that thing.
Yeah, and look, I think it's not something... It's actually something that I've only reflected on since like doing things like this, because I think you're right, your natural desire is just to assimilate, isn't it? You just try and blend in. And I suppose as a kid, you're always trying to do that. And I sort of wondered whether everyone has that experience. You know, when I talk to my husband, who is comfortably white and middle class, he still remembers trying to fit in and trying to herd with the crowd and blend with the crowd. So I wonder if it's just that journey that everyone goes on, where you, as you grow up, you're trying to find your place and you herd and you blend. Yeah. But as you get older, you're kind of like, well, you actually become more selective about what you want to be part of, and that difference becomes the primary driver instead. You know, you're like, actually, I don't want to be part of that. I want to be something else or something different or something even completely unique. So
maybe. I mean, I've really started thinking about exactly that thing when I read Wonder. Have you read Wonder or seen the film Wonder?
No.
You've got kids, right? Yeah. You should see Wonder or read Wonder with them. It's amazing, the book Wonder. It's about this kid who's got Treacher-Collins syndrome, which is this horrendous birth defect where your face is just
Is this the one where the kid wears a helmet?
Yeah, he wears a helmet because his face just looks like he's been in a fire. It's awful. He has all these operations, and then he gets to a stage where he can go to a normal, inverted commas, normal school. And obviously when he gets to the normal school, the bullies and the name calling and the, you know, the horrible stuff that he goes through. And he goes through this journey of just not wanting to take the helmet off and being ashamed, to eventually just making peace with what he is. It's got a brilliant tagline in the film and the book, which is "Why fit in when you're born to stand out?" Which is just it's just a beautiful thing. It's a great book.
Yeah.
What about like sort of still touching on that, still staying on that the upbringing? How about in Cambridge, which I imagine was fairly sort of Caucasian and one-dimensional sort of racially? Did you have any experiences with racism, you know, the direct kind or maybe even the subtle kind?
I think this is, again, a really weird one, because I think I'm really lucky that I can sort of hand on my heart say, not really. I think the thing with Cambridge is that it is well-educated and open-minded, right? So yes, it is homogeneously white, but the kind of intellectual capacity or the kind of, the exposure to the world was quite great. And so I had that, then I had Oxford, which was similar, and then obviously advertising, I went straight in. And again, everywhere you went, it was white homogeneity, but I suppose the open-mindedness or the tolerance meant that there wasn't sort of negative associations around being brown. But I suppose I've always over-indexed on my whiteness. So I think the way I speak, the way I dress, the kind of way I live my life are inherently white. Yeah. And I almost make a joke of that before anyone else can, you know. So I'm always joking about that I'm a complete bloody coconut, you know. I'm brown on the outside, white on the inside. You know, I always talk about how my parents wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer or an accountant, and advertising was completely left field. Or, you know, I'll do take the piss Indian accents so that almost you stop people doing it of you because you own it yourself, and you kind of, you turn it into your own positive, your own joke or story. So I guess, yeah, I'm lucky that I don't think anyone's, you know, shouted "Hey, Packy" on the street or anything. But I suppose I also then, I've maybe overcompensated to go out my way to present a very un-Indian kind of version. I don't feel necessarily like people would instantly think that because of the way I look and the way I talk. Yeah.
It's interesting you say that, because a few people that we've had on the podcast have had experience, including me, have had experiences with racism, both sort of physical and people shouting things and all of those stuff. But a couple of people that I've talked about coming on have said, I'll come on, but I've never had any racism. My skin colour's never actually been mentioned until you've spoken to me now. I've sort of never really thought of it as a thing. So I can come and talk, but I haven't really got any insight into what that's like, which sounds like that chimes with your experience.
It does, pretty much. You know, like I think it's something that's in your head all the time, but isn't necessarily an experience that I've encountered with the world. So again, I think I'm lucky, maybe, because yeah, it's been pretty positive, you know.
And what about, you touched again on the podcast itself. The reason I started this podcast was around partly giving people role models, people that maybe are feeling different and are starting out their careers, particularly that are from different backgrounds and looking into the industry and thinking, oh, it's quite homogenous, so there's not many brown people or Chinese people or whatever it may be. I just really wanted to sort of point out some role models and say, well, look at this person and this person, they're doing amazing things. Did you have role models starting out, mentors or people that helped you, or heroes in advertising?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I definitely agree with you. It was definitely a wall of white when I joined. And so everyone that was a mentor to me was pretty much a white bloke, you know, like that's who were in the industry. And again, another really weird one, my grad intake, it was me and another girl called Priya Patel. And it was extraordinary. Like, she kept bumping into people with the same name. But she was, I guess, much more Indian than I was. She spoke Hindi. She brought Indian food into the agency. She kind of dressed sometimes in Indian clothes. Yep. And so it was interesting. Like, we were differentiated again. Like, we were, you know, two slightly different people. But I guess I used to joke, yeah, that I was the only Indian person in account handling in London. And I suppose I went in and I just tried to learn the skills of the industry, right? So all of the people that were mentors to me were just great suits. And I suppose at the time, all of those great suits happened to be white, posh blokes. So I think the idea that you can be a great suit, but not that, is something that's really, you know, needs to be pushed, or is a great thing to be able to celebrate.
But you, so I suppose in that, back in those days, did that ever seem like an issue to you? I've talked about this, if you can't see it, you can't be it type of thing, but it sounds like to you, you just saw great people and, you know, and learned from those great people. Who cares what colour they are, kind of thing?
I think there's several things, right? So when you grow up in an environment where you feel quite confident, you know, I was quite a confident 18-year-old, 20-year-old, and so I marched on in there as if I belonged there. And I think that comfort in that white world has been something that I've known since I was 8 years old, you know, because that's been my life. So I think for me, it wasn't necessarily a barrier. I also think maybe like the old school world of advertising was brand out, right? It was all about work out what Lipton Iced Tea want to say and then find a way to say that in a really distinctive way. And I think sort of some of the more sophisticated, kind of more consumer-led, behaviour-led kind of insight and thinking in the industry is relatively new. And it's only when you're going down that lens or trying to look at brands from that lens that maybe you look around and go, hang on, we've not got one fucker in the room that might understand this from that person's perspective. Is this something we need to solve for? So I think it's become an agency agenda and a reasonable agency agenda, because suddenly everyone's kind of just thinking about the business in a slightly different way.
Starting from the people that you want to talk to rather than starting from what the brand wants to tell people. And going on to that diversity, the world of diversity, it's become a buzzword. You know, everyone's having chief diversity officers and all of those, the quotas and targets and all of those things. What's your take on that? What do you see as the right way to move things forward?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. Answers.
There you go. There's that hot potato for you.
Well, do you know what? I really flux on quotas. So I've been quite interested in all the political experiments in Ghana and Norway, where you look at the long-term impact of having women, a quota of women that are in government, and actually it has a really positive impact. Like, the women's agendas that would never otherwise be discussed or debated in parliament, policies that genuinely help women, are being brought up and made into law. So there's this massive long-term advantage to having the quota. But the short-term problem is that obviously you're likely to fuck over people who are better qualified for the role. So that short-term immediate problem is that you might just be better at this, but you're going to be overlooked to tick a box. So I suppose ultimately I end up feeling, okay, so it's not quite fair, it's not quite right. So then you go, well, what could you do and what is the best way forward? And I think, so partly something like this, like raising awareness and kind of I think advertising is a very sort of white middle class industry, and you only sort of stumble across it if you happen to be in that sort of socioeconomic band or you know someone that's sort of doing it. And so I think trying to get the industry in front of more diverse groups of people is kind of quite interesting. So going into schools or going into universities and presenting the profession, if you like, just to go, did you even know that there is this whole multi-billion industry that you might want to be part of? I think there are some really small things that people can do. Like if you removed names and genders from CVs when you were looking at them, I think there'd be quite a shift in who you actually then met for the first round. And I also remember, like, back in the day when you did grad recruitment, I don't know if you remember this, but like when you applied to Grey, you'd do like a video, or when you applied to DDB, there'd be like three questions, and it'd almost just be like the quality of your questions or your ability to answer three random things rather or do something creative rather than your CV per se. And I think that could just unlock just some different people coming, right? And the response you might get from, you know, a 16-year-old kid in Parramatta might just blow you out the, you know, blow some sort of 20-year-old graduate out the park just for its inventiveness or its difference. Or so I just think finding different mechanics to open the industry to people is quite, it's probably the most, the easiest way of kind of changing it a little bit or kind of shifting it a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. I mean, I just think at the moment that 16-year-old kid in Parramatta who could be amazing, he just doesn't even know that the world of advertising even exists.
No.
And he's, you know, he's going to go and do something in his dad's business and probably do pretty well. But we're just missing out on that perspective, on that talent, all of those things. So just for me, somehow finding a way to fish in a broader pond, which would involve going out to Parramatta and talking to that kid.
100%.
For sure. And then just, yeah, like you say, the CV thing, it reminds me of, I can't remember when they started it, but you know in orchestras when they're auditioning for new musicians, they do behind the curtain.
Yeah.
Everyone's got to take their shoes off because if you've got, you can tell if females are wearing certain kinds of shoes, so barefoot, and then you can't tell if it's male or female. I think because there's that whole unconscious bias and all that sort of thing. So.
Yeah, it was like The Voice. I mean, The Voice is literally mass entertainment, like playing, everyone acknowledges that we go for pretty people and pretty people can skew your view of someone's singing ability. So you just turn the chair around and see what happens. It's kind of very interesting.
You know, when they, you know, when someone's amazing on The Voice and then they spin round and they go, oh my God, it's not what I expected. You
100%.
Think, what are you expecting from someone really good looking? Or it's a bit insulting.
I know.
What was I going to say? I was going to say that, you talked about quotas versus where I'm at is more just having conversations and working out ways that we can all work together. Who cares what colour people's skin are, but for people to just come together in the industry and beyond and just have conversations that move us forward versus you must have 22% of this, that and the other. It just, it's got to be a better way. But I just want it to move more quickly than it is personally.
I think it is sort of cultural as well, right? So if leadership believe that diversity is valuable or that difference, I think it's actually difference is valuable, then it happens because they actively try and bring that into the organisation or find ways to, I think it's about openness, right? To try and open the conversation and do it. And also, look, I think there's it's okay to be honest that there is a perception problem that we've got to address, and this is something that I'd like to work with everyone to address. You know, like I think that is the way that you sort of do it, by making everyone take a collective responsibility for the reputation of DDB. You know, I couldn't single-handedly fix that. It would require all 250 of us to believe and want to create the same type of environment. And it attracts people or it sends people away. And that is what agencies almost differentiate on, I'd say. Like, it's the culture, it's the environment that makes one different from the next. So I think making it what you want it to be as a leader is really important. It does put some pressure on you to kind of set your bar and set your expectations for how you want people to behave.
Yeah. So I mean, while we're on that, we're setting agendas in agencies and building cultures and so on. We mentioned DDB. You've been over here a year or?
We got it June 2017.
Okay.
So, for a little while.
You and your team at DDB recently won Campaign Brief Agency of the Year, which was absolutely epic and super well deserved. I think the thing I loved about that was that it was not off the back of one great big amazing project, but there were several, three, four, five amazing clients that were doing great work all at the same time, big, yeah, famous, real work, you know, really inspiring. What did that, not just what did the Agency of the Year thing mean to you, but what did the, you know, the success across all those things mean to you?
Yeah, do you know what? It's hugely exciting. I guess I obviously joined DDB because I could see it was a brilliant agency. I feel like I'm really goal hanging here, if I'm honest. Like, I just walked in and then we won Agency of the Year, and I somehow get some of the credit for that. But, you know, it is a culture that I really responded to. It's that genuine, talented and nice ethos. And I think from that culture come these really long-term partnerships with clients. You know, we've had Macca's for 48 years. That's out-survives any CEO or MD. It's about the cultural relationship between those two parties, and I think trying to keep that going and trying to build that across all of our clients and trying to keep that interesting, right? Like, after 48 years of selling a Big Mac, how do you do that in an interesting, innovative way, I think is a huge challenge. And I think our team are really brilliant at that, of just coming at these real problems every single day and trying to do something amazing. And I love the enthusiasm and the passion that everyone brings for, and the commerciality. You know, everyone goes, this is an actual real thing that's going to drive a commercial outcome. And that does make people excited. So the creativity isn't a means in and of itself. I think everybody wants to do something that actually can shift a business or impact a behaviour, or, you know, make a difference. So
how do you guys and ladies sort of do it across so consistently across so many things, though? I mean, I've worked in DDB, there's some amazing people, but just to have such strength in depth across your VW, your Macca's, your Westpac, all of that, you know, amazing people on all of those things.
Yeah,
it's unprecedented, I think. It's definitely in the market anyway.
Thank you. That's very kind. I certainly can't take all the credit. I think, you know, AL definitely has sort of set it up. I think one of the things we're really trying to build on every single account is a kind of partnership, a trio, if you like, of a managing partner, a creative partner and a strat partner who take responsibility for that business and drive it. And they're three equal partners who deliver that business outcome for Westpac. And I'm really lucky. I've got, you know, all of those accounts have an amazingly strong suit, creative and planner that work on it. And as I said, yeah, lots of people who've been at DDB for a really long time, and so, you know, been there 20 years, been there 15 years, so they know these clients or they know these brands really well, and they kind of have that energy to just keep kind of refreshing them, I guess, and future-proofing them. So I think it does come back to culture. Hopefully it is a place that people want to stay and enjoy working, and I think relationships with clients that actually feel like partnerships, and you're not a kind of like third rate studio, get barked at. You know, we're lucky, we've got great clients who are incredibly respectful of what we do and treat us like partners. So yes, I can't say there's any one secret ingredient, but it just feels like it's a good kind of overall mix. And as I said, every department having an equal weight, so it's not like a creative dominated agency or a suit led agency. Everybody brings something to the party.
And just in terms of the structure, while you've got those really strong trios of creative partner, managing partner and strategic partner, where do you see your role, your personal role in that?
Because you just kind of goal hanging,
you sort of goal hanging across the top, across all of it.
But I think obviously I get deeper in some clients than others, and same with AL, we're sort of more deeply embedded in other clients. But I think our role is to actually future-proof the whole business. It's kind of to set things like the cultural tone and protect the cultural tone. It's to make everyone want to come and work in that space. It's everything from, you know, toilets that work, lights that people can see, activities that people want to be part of, PRing and talking and celebrating about the work. You know, I think that's what we all do as leaders, and make it a genuinely brilliant place that people want to come and work. And I feel like I can only do that with, you know, Tara and Ben and Carl and Leif and AL, you know. Yeah, we do it all together.
Some seriously good people. I mean, just going back, winding back a bit from DDB, just back into the past, because you've obviously worked at some amazing places in London before you got here, and you've worked on, as we mentioned, you've worked on some awesome, famous, quite iconic campaigns. Virgin Media, Fantastic Journey was awesome. Marks and Spencer's, some of the food porn stuff is obviously much loved and long running. The Britain's Leading Ladies campaign. I'd mentioned the Harvey Nicks calendars work. I remember when I was kind of no one and had nothing, and just had this DDB, DNAD annual that I would just pour over and would look at the calendars work in there and just think, God, one day if I could just do something as amazing as that. What would you see as the highlights so far?
Oh, it's a tough one. That
all of that, or
yeah.
Something
do you
else?
Know what? I loved M&S. I love big, fast, high volume, if I'm honest. Like, I love being at the pointy end of commercialism. I worked on the BBC for a while and I loved it, but I found that kind of sort of 18-month cycle to come up with an iPlayer launch quite hard. Like, I like the day in, day out commercial pace activity because I think it's a real challenge, you know, like a meaty challenge. So when you get something up like Leading Ladies on M&S, you know that you've really got something up. You know, it's the same on Macca's, it's the same on VW. They are big commercial clients, but it's even harder to get something really brave up because they've got all of these pressures, the machine just churns. So yeah, I love fast and a bit kind of fast and high volume, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you're running towards the things most people are running away from.
Well, exactly. And I think actually that is something I did in my career. When I joined Virgin Media, was a bit of a horror show at Rainy Kelly. Nobody wanted to work on it. We had Lloyd's and we had Marks and Spencer's and we had all these beautiful accounts. And Virgin Media was like this new sort of horrible tech thing. But actually, I think that's where I see the greatest opportunity. Like, if an account is really shit, the only way it can go is better. And actually, it's probably the richest space to do something really great or creative or unusual. I mean, Harvey Nicks was obviously brilliant, but it was... it was small, and you know, I love that kind of work. I love retail, actually, but you were sort of pulling in favours and kind of like, you know, they had £12.50, and you were kind of trying to get photographers to do it for free, world class fashion photographers to do it for free, models who were doing
but
it
that
for
Harvey
free.
Nicks sale brief must have been the one every year that everyone, you know, that was year
absolutely
after year
and the M&S Christmas brief, and you know, I actually think that my job or part of my job is to help create those briefs, right? So every client can do one of those. You just got to find it, you got to mine it, you got to understand that business and go, right, that's an opportunity for you, and then give it to some clever creative people and they'll do something wonderful with it. So I don't know, that's why I guess why I like the big, because there's always money, they're always making stuff. You're not just sitting around waiting for some money to pop up from somewhere. They've got the budgets, it's just about turning that spend into an opportunity and doing something, you know, completely amazing with it.
So while we're continuing this thread on the work itself, what's the stuff that you see out there that really excites and inspires you at the moment, either from this market or sort of around the world?
Yeah, I am. Well, obviously, I'm in the QSR category, so I loved the KFC stuff from London, like, you know, the Unforgettable Apology. It's just brave, right? It's brave to have fucked up that royally and then actually lean into it. And we did something similar actually on M&S when we started charging women with bigger boobs more money for their bras.
And then we put out, and
obviously everyone went mental. The nation went absolutely mental. So we put out a big we've boobed kind of, you know, DPS.
Yeah.
And it was like, it was brave for Marks and Spencer to go, we've really fucked this up. It's completely the wrong thing to do. We're going back to charging you the same. We love your big tits. And I think KFC have done a brilliant job of that as well. It's like, we're a chicken shop with no fucking chicken. Is a pretty appalling state of affairs. But to own that and to go out and be brave with it, you know.
God, they did an amazing job of turning what was basically a press ad, a one-page press ad, into something that just turned into an epic
they really
PR
did.
Campaign.
Yeah. I love the... I love the the Cheetos Museum stuff as well. Like, so random, so funny, so actually insightful about how people use that brand. Like, I don't know, I clearly love dirty junk food advertising. that's my sweet spot. But I suppose those are two that globally I thought, oh, they've caught my eye and I'm sort of interested in. Yeah. New Zealand have recently done a new Spates campaign, which I thought was really great as well. It's kind of like a Japanese remix and it's just beautiful TV ad, but it looks phenomenal. Like, the production quality on it is really great.
I've not seen that.
So yes, that's a new one. Maybe it hasn't launched yet.
That's interesting, because I was just going to say to you that the things you mentioned, the mother work for KFC and the Cheetos stuff, that neither of those are big TV, classic TV ads. DDB does a lot of classic TV, among a load of other stuff, but you do a lot of just great, beautifully polished TV ads. Where's your passion?
I like a bit of both. Is that a cheat? Honestly, I think that's the formula. Like, I think that's what we try to deliver for brands. Like, you have to build long-term brand saliency. That is big, epic, long-form, beautifully crafted TV, as usually. You might be able to do it with some lovely out-of-home or something, but usually it's a film that helps you connect emotionally. And I think brands that don't do any of that suffer in the long term because it doesn't build any memory structures. But brands who only do that, it is self-indulgent. It doesn't convert. You do you need to be activating in the short term. And I think sometimes when you want to be really targeted as well, so kind of the stuff we did with Polo Unfail, where we're basically trying to reach a Gen Z, you know, like under 25 year olds, to try and talk to them about safety, like you can't do a big bloody TV ad for that. It's got to be a much more nimble, smart approach. So I guess I really do buy into that long and short of it. Build the brand in the long term, activate in the short term, and it's just about getting the blend right. I suppose I still love print and out of home as well, though. I love a poster. I feel like no one in Australia really loves posters as much. They seem quite functional instead of just, you know, really iconic and beautiful, and like, you know, the craft around photography and all of that kind of stuff. I mean, maybe that's a bit unfair, but just. I love a bit of out of home.
You've just sort of led into my next question, which was going to be, because we talked about sort of work around the world that you love and that kind of thing, but I was going to specifically touch on the market that we're in, Australia. You've been here a relatively short sort of space of time, but you know, personally, I think you turn on the TV here and a lot of the time you've got ex-footy players shouting at you to get down to some crap sale, when you drive around the, you know, down the road and you've just got sort of horrendously, you know, horrendous posters that have got big, massive, clunky typography and stuff. You know, you walk around, I know this is idealising it a bit, but you walk around London and people love out of home. Or, you know, you drive around LA and there's just beautiful out of home posters. In London, you know, in the UK, TVCs are in the main, there's some beautiful TV work. I don't think the work's as of a higher standard here as it is in some places. What do you think?
Oh, it's a tricky one. Look, I think ANZ sort of more than holds its own, given its scale and size. And I think that is a big factor, actually. Like, I think about London, think about New York, just the population density, how many bites of the cherry, therefore, there are because of all the media ops that there are. So you've got more brands, more chances to get it right. But yeah, I think there's some hilarious... It's wall-to-wall VO. That's like on the TV ads. And then we always crack up that it's like, in Australia, Australians. And you're like, really? Like, do you have to say the word Australian 50 times in a 30-second? I think kerning does my nut when it's just all horrible and wonky. And that, I just don't know why it looks like that. You know, you're like, why is there no space? Like, but that's a sort of sweeping and perhaps negative generalisation. I think for the ops that there are, and I do think there are fewer bites of the cherry, I think Australia holds its own against the rest of the world. I think it could do more, obviously. Like, you look at New Zealand and it feels like they are always more on fire than we are. We're almost like small, we're like the poor commercial cousin rather than adopting kind of the New Zealand entrepreneurial bit. We're almost like a diluted version of London or New York, and I think maybe not trying to be that, trying to create the your own thing is a better way forward, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a theory on this. I'm desperately worried that I don't want to get you into trouble in any of this, or myself into trouble, but I've just got this theory that clients are just a little bit braver in London, particularly because I've got a lot of experience in London. I found that the clients in London would want to be brave because they would want to do work that would make them famous, so they could go and get some amazing job in New York. So they just come to me and say, "Ant, make me famous, make me look good."
Yeah.
Whereas here, people don't want a job in New York because it's beautiful here and the weather's lovely and it's
life's
just
good.
Don't rock the boat. Let's just kind of all, you know, it's all good.
Yeah, I think that's actually fair. Like, I think brave work is linked to client confidence, right? It's kind of like they've got to feel confident, like they want to do something different, like they want to shake things up. I think it's hard. You look at their tenure here, the average tenure is something like 18 months. So I imagine they feel all the time like their job's at risk, and the idea of therefore being brave just is like a stupid thing to say to them. They're like, I'm being brave by just turning up every day for work. So I think our approach more is to go, this makes sense, this can do brilliant things for your business. Creativity is the unlock to your business. You'll be more successful if you are more creative, you know, and trying to go at it from a sort of logical business perspective rather than a kind of, this will make you famous or this will make you good. But I know what you mean. Like, I absolutely had clients at Marks & Spencer's, at Virgin Media, just come to me and say, I don't know what the answer is, I just want something fucking amazing, go. And that was the brief. And you'd be like, oh, okay, well, we can definitely do that. We can definitely just deliver fucking amazing. I haven't had that one yet. But I think with all of our clients, as I said, we've got that longevity, and I think we can go to them and go, we think this is an op to do something really brave and different. And I know on VW, on Macca's, on Virgin, they're hugely receptive to that. So I think it is building that partnership, right, as
well. It's like you say as well, though, the brave thing, sort of, brave again in inverted commas would be to do something really safe and boring, because you're really dicing with death if you don't stand out. Business is not gonna is not gonna be booming.
Yeah, I almost think as well, if the churn is so high, you might as well just roll the dice and see, right? Like, if you think you're gonna be gone in 18 months anyway, maybe you just go, oh, I'll just try something really different and brave, and I don't know, maybe I'll be out, but maybe it'll work. Yeah. So
I think the key is, personally, I think, but you'll know much better than me, much better about this than me, because it's more your role. I think the key is having conversations with clients about the kind of bravery they should be embracing that feels like a genuine partnership, not things that are self-serving for agencies because
Absolutely.
We want to do some cool thing or win some award or whatever, but because we are genuine partners and we think it's the right thing to do for the business.
Completely. Look, I think there's an absolute correlation between creativity and business effectiveness, and I think that's the bit that we have to keep hammering home, which is the more creative, inventive, kind of imaginative you are, the better your business will trade. And I think it's easy to forget that, and it is easy to just to do something safe and vanilla, but it's actually, as you say, counterintuitive to what you're trying to achieve. I do think it is, yeah, partnerships, feeling like the clients trust you. You have to earn that trust. I think it's not as instantly granted here. The relationship maybe with agencies is slightly different. Like, I felt like in London we had that automatic C-suite table. What we did was very valuable. Creating the brand was very valuable. It added value to the bottom line. I feel like here you still have to defend marketing spend a lot more, and you have to show, build a case for investment and what it can deliver in terms of ROI. Maybe because budgets are smaller, it's more pressured, etc., etc.
Yeah. I mean, what about the whole cause marketing thing, for example? I think these days it feels like every brand seems to find a need to jump on to a higher meaning or some kind of cause, with, you know, charities or whatever it may be. I think some brands like Nike feel that feels credible and authentic. It's sort of baked into their DNA. Others feel a little bit like they're jumping on a bandwagon.
Yeah. I definitely think it's almost like a conversation that we were having in the UK like 10 years ago, right, where all the brands were suddenly trying to come up with a purpose and you're kind of like, why are we all doing this? And maybe there's just that slight lag. And even in the UK, they've gone back round to, if you have that baked into your DNA, then cool, you should absolutely celebrate it, you know. And a lot of brands that I think are being created now do have social purpose baked in, because I think it will become a more important factor for decision making as this generation comes up. But I think currently nobody buys because of, you know, this nappy's gonna change the world. People buy the nappy because it soaks up the wee. And I think we need, as marketeers or creative people, need to kind of understand really why someone is opting into a brand and then leverage that, rather than trying to make up a fictional truth about it and kind of try and make that a reality.
Well, what about, though, for example, the Gillette thing that was recently? Because I thought that was interesting, because they have been for 30 or 40 years saying Gillette, the best a man can get, or, you know, whatever, which was just so sort of behind the times. And I thought it was interesting that they took that on the chin and they turned around and said, well, actually, is it the best a man can get? Maybe that's something else. And how that got executed, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
But it was definitely an interesting move.
I'm with you. I think Gillette is probably one of the brands that for a long time has perpetuated a sort of 80s stereotypical view of a buff bloke and what a bloke is like. He's a buff bloke looking in the mirror with a girl weirdly stroking his face. It's really fucking strange. But I think it's actually interesting for them to go, is this really the best we can be? Isn't there a different view of masculinity? And to be open to that. I think there's lots of behaviour that has to sit underneath that to make that credible, though, right? So the fact that women's razors still cost so much more than men's razors and all of that kind of stuff, I think, is people kind of go, hang on, are you really about equality? Are you really about kind of this bigger position on making men better guys? I think you sort of have to deliver it at every kind of touch point if you're going to do it. So I don't think it's wrong that they try, but I think you've got to follow through really coherently throughout the business to make it a reality.
Yeah, I think also they said they had been saying for years, this is the best a man can get, which is the weird guy looking in the mirror with a girl stroking his face.
Yeah.
Very odd. But then they said, oh, no, it's not that, it's this. And then they showed me something else. And I was like, well, I don't know if that is the best a man can get either. And they,
yes.
I don't really need you to be telling me what that is.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, though, if it's just about saying, for me, all I took out of that was there might be alternative views of masculinity, and that's cool, and we should celebrate it. You know, I think that the outrage against it was a bit, I was a bit surprised, if I'm honest, because I didn't think they were being critical. I think they were trying to be celebratory of men and different men. But I don't think people took it out like that. I think it came across as preachy and a bit kind of like patronising. Yes. Yeah. I mean, executionally, it was a bit of a horror show.
Yeah.
But I thought the sentiment behind it about, I don't know, the pressures of masculinity and there being different or more optimal ways of being a bloke, especially I think in America, in the light of all the kind of pussy grabbing, horrible kind of male, and the Me Too movement, that sense that blokes are just this horrible, one dimensional, masculine, sexual beast. I don't know. I thought they were trying to tackle that head on, and it was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Whether they did it successfully or not, and whether they implemented it through their business, I think are different.
Well,
things.
For sure, if they'd have implemented it through their business more tangibly, that would have made a massive difference. I mean, it reminds me of the Fearless Girl thing, where they went around the world winning lots of awards and making a big deal about something,
I never
and
quite
then
got that.
when everyone looked into it, that company had no females on the board, and it just had a terrible record, and had not sort of followed through on any of the stuff that was supposed to be about.
Yeah. No, I think brands have to live and breathe it if they're going to go into that purpose thing. And so, look, do I think it's wrong that brands strive to create one or go for one? Probably not. Like, I think a lot of clients have to get with that. You know, Volkswagen has to think about green and electric. McDonald's has to think about plastic and sustainability. It's not wrong for these to be agendas for these brands. But I think hanging your entire hat on it, that isn't why most people buy a VW, and it isn't why most people buy a burger. So you just got to, I think, find the balance of it.
Yeah, I think find the balance and find the right relevant way in as well. Because the ones you mentioned, VW talking about the environment or McDonald's talking about plastic, that makes sense to me. I think when you've got burger brands talking about mental health, it just all gets a bit random and a bit, where are these things coming from?
That
starts to feel a little bit jumping on
commercial. I think often those kind of stories as well validate a decision, but they don't drive a decision or a purchase decision. Like, you don't buy a burger brand because you think they're going to do something about bullying. You do it because you think that it's going to be a delicious burger. And I think just keeping it a bit real about what we're actually in market to do is, I think important.
And then just moving on a bit, I just wanted to go sort of circle back to that diversity, staying with the work, but circle back to that diversity thing, because I've got a strong belief, but I've kind of got no proof on this, that there's a correlation between the kind of work that we do, that we're doing as an industry, and the diversity or lack of diversity in the industry. And I've just got this theory that the more diverse the inputs, whether that's ethnic or cultural or socioeconomic or gender, whatever you might want to, whatever we might want to talk about, the more diversity in those inputs, the more rich and diverse and better the work will be coming out of the back of that. I mean, does that hold water for you, that argument? Or
I think creativity is always about finding a different or a lateral or a, left brain view of something. And so if you've got a load of people who all think the same, you're possibly not going to get that left brain lateral view of it. So I think having as much difference as possible will improve creativity. And as I said, I think creativity is at the heart of driving great business outcomes. So I definitely think there was no downside to having a more diverse group of people working in a business.
And I mean, even outside of the group, but if we think about just the people, the individuals, I mentioned at the start, you're a lover of good books on one hand and cheesy R&B on the other. I think that sort of strikes me as quite a British thing. I think as a people, we're lovers of Carry On movies and Benny Hill on one hand, and we love Virginia Woolf and Dickens and whatever else on the other hand.
Yeah.
And I think that mix of the cerebral and the more mainstream popular culture is a good thing for people in advertising to have.
Yeah,
it just helps you bring new answers to briefs.
Yeah, I completely agree. I like reading books. I like quite cerebral books. I like science books. I like Dawkins, and I like How the Body Works and all those kind of things. I've started reading Michelle Obama's kind of biography. I think she's amazing. But I love trash TV. I'll watch 13 Reasons Why. I love teen dramas. I love vampire dramas, and I think it's nice to just turn off your brain. So I think it's good to stimulate your brain, provoke your brain, and then actually just give it a rest as well. And I think trash can really do that, whether it's a book or
Can we just a point of order here though? Can we just define trash? Because I think 13 Reasons Why was quite sort of
thought provoking.
Right, actually.
I know.
Trash. I just can't handle it. I suppose
it's still a teen drama.
Yeah.
My husband always mocks me that I'm sort of so interested in the lives of 17-year-olds, like clinging on to like what it was like to be 18. No, but you're right. At least it was a thought-provoking kind of content. Yeah. Vampire dramas are always ridiculous, though, right? Like teenage girls, always a weird librarian, and then a handsome Dracula person who wants to kill you, but you kind of love. You know, it's weird. It's a weird dynamic.
Yeah, it's a formula, definitely a formula.
It's definitely a formula, but I think it does just switch off your brain. I love mindlessness.
What about the real? Because there's an obsession with reality dating shows, Married at First Sight, and I just can't. I don't really like trash.
That's car crash, isn't it? I feel that's car crash. That's like literally watching humans combust on a screen, and I think that's slightly different because I think that's quite exploitative. I think with a teen drama, it's a fictional kind of ridiculous thing that you watch and you go, okay. You're invited into the fantasy. I think with things like Married at First Sight, it's genuinely manipulative and quite psychotic. Some of the things that happen. Yeah, I'm like, I haven't really been able to watch any of those. I've sort of tuned into a couple of episodes, and they're sort of weirdly fascinating for one. But then when you actually think that this is someone's actual life, it's a bit terrifying. So it's the same with all the X Factors and The Voices. Like, I think there's almost reality fatigue. Well, there is in my world anyway. But again, you remember when Big Brother came out on Channel 4, like, 70 years ago, and it was a sort of novel format then, when you kind of went, looking at ourselves as humans is an interesting thing. But I'm sort of like, I'm a bit tired now of looking at ourselves. Let's create some myths again. I think that's why Netflix are just going gangbusters. It's like the OA is the weirdest fucking narrative, but it's like wonderful and crazy, and that's so much more interesting to me than watching someone with, you know, fake boobs talk about how sad she feels that the bloke that she married yesterday doesn't love her. You know, it's just kind of a bit weird as a human science experiment. I prefer the crazy stuff.
There was a weird moment, I think, in culture, or in my brain anyway, where we went from all the Big Brother stuff and the reality stuff to just thinking, oh, these people are quite interesting, to thinking, oh, but these people aren't actually talented at doing anything, like telling us stories or singing great songs or writing great music. They've just kind of been on Big Brother and...
Well, their longevity afterwards just isn't there, right? So if you look at actors and singers, and I think their longevity comes simply from talent, whereas reality stars, well, Kim Kardashian's had to keep reinventing herself, hasn't she? Her ass, her lips, her whatever.
She's done very well.
She has done very well, yeah.
This has been awesome. It's been really, really fascinating. Thank you so much for coming on. We do a thing where at the end of the podcast, I like to try and finish with something from the guest that is a thought or an insight or an experience, an anecdote, a neat little quote, something that you've learned or gleaned from your experience. Can you leave us with something?
Oh, cracking. This is where you sort of try to have to be wise, right? Yeah. Actually, there was an Oscar Wilde quote that I really liked, because I think one of the things that I think is really great about what you're trying to do is show difference. But actually, I think part of it as well is identifying the humanity that makes us all the same as well. So there was one Oscar Wilde quote, because I know you said something, you know, we're all in the gutter, but some of us are looking at the stars. And I just quite like that. Kind of like, it's just, there is a collective human experience and we're all living it somehow, but it's just kind of like trying to shoot for the dream as best we can.
Love that. Thank you.
No worries.
Cheers.
Thank you for having me. Hey!
Thank you to you for listening, and thank you to the guys at Smith & Weston for pulling this together. Dan and Nick here are absolute legends in sound. From creating original music tracks, stings and sound effects, to recording VOs, radio commercials and podcasts, they're master craftsmen, an absolute joy to work with, and genuine supporters of positive steps in the industry. So please keep them in mind for all your sound requirements. Thanks again. Until next time.